Early research shows that there are benefits for women who use mindfulness techniques to turn toward the experience of childbirth rather than run away from it.
Often there's more suffering and distress when we are in the effort of trying to avoid or struggle against something that we don't like, as opposed to just being with it as it is and sort of allowing it to unfold as it does.
We speak with a University of Illinois psychology professor who studies mindfulness and meditation and a midwife who's teaching these skills to pregnant women. Plus, a new law signed last month is focusing on advancing dental health care in rural areas. How might communities in southern Illinois benefit? But first, Senator Tammy Duckworth joins us from Washington. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Last night, President Donald Trump gave an address from the Oval Office, the first of his presidency, as we enter day 19 of the federal government shutdown, a result of the argument between the president and Congress over a wall on our southern border. Just before we went to air, I had a chance to speak with one of our senators, Sammy Duckworth. Good morning, Senator Duckworth. Welcome back to the 21st.
Good morning. It's good to be on.
Let's start with that Oval Office address. President Trump said he presented Congress with a, quote, detailed proposal from Homeland Security to secure the border. And I wanted to repeat some of the details of what he said last night so you could respond to it. He said the proposal involves cutting-edge technology for detecting drugs, weapons, illegal contraband. He said they've requested more agents, immigration judges, and bed space. He said their plan also includes an urgent request for humanitarian assistance and medical support. What in that plan would you support?
Well, I already voted to support all of those things, and we gave him $1.3 billion last year, which he still has not spent, for all of those things. Increased border security, more agents, more drones, more fencing, more resources to the Department of Homeland Security. So he already has those resources that he hasn't even been able to spend. The plan that they gave us this past week does not go into that great of a detail and frankly includes a lot of false information on what is actually happening at the border. And the humanitarian crisis that's happening at the border is one that President Trump created by separating families and separating children from their parents at the border, resulting in at least two deaths that we know of so far.
With that said, what path do you see going forward here then?
Well, the Republican path, frankly, it's the one that I voted on along with every other United States senator at the end of December. We had a negotiated bill to reopen government, to keep government open, actually. We had not shut government down yet. Mitch McConnell brought it to the floor, and it passed unanimously. Every single senator voted for it, and that would keep the government open. The House just passed a version of that bill that would open six of the seven agencies, leaving just the Department of Homeland Security on a temporary budget that would allow us to negotiate further additional funding, but we would at least keep government open and working for the people. Both of those are Republican bills that were negotiated by Republican leads that have passed in a bipartisan way, and I certainly would vote for them, either one again, if I were allowed to.
Senator Duckworth, so even though there's a federal government shutdown, you're still introducing bills and all of that. We're going to talk about some of them in a few minutes. I believe this is a second shutdown since you've been in Congress, right? I wonder, is your life essentially unchanged in the terms of the amount of work you're doing, even though we're in the middle of this shutdown?
Well, if anything, we're doing more work because we're making sure to reach out to constituents who are potentially affected by the shutdown, both federal employees as well as people in Illinois who are facing some pretty severe consequences. For example, if this shutdown keeps on going, it's going to affect the school lunch program for children. It's going to affect SNAP benefits. Farmers are going to see that their applications for emergency funding to compensate for their losses from the trade war that President Trump started, those applications are not going to be processed. So we're doing our regular jobs as well as dealing with the negative fallout from this Trump shutdown.
And I've seen some reports that there are about that estimate around 10,000 federal workers in Illinois that are directly affected by the shutdown. Are you hearing from them as well?
I am hearing from them, and I'm actually making phone calls today to key agencies that are affected. There are federal agencies all throughout the state that do everything from research and development to, as I mentioned, direct support for our farm and our agricultural and sector, and also education programs for our children.
And when we're thinking about science funding in particular, and I know us being home to Argonne and Fermi National Labs, thinking about funding at universities and research that depends on science funding, have you reached out to those folks as well?
Yes, and don't forget that we have the Peoria Ag Lab as well. That is the only one of its kind in the nation and does some pretty cutting-edge research, and they're being shut down as well.
I want to ask you about something unrelated to the shutdown, which was that yesterday, Senator Durbin and you and 38 other senators reintroduced the Background Check Expansion Act that would expand federal background checks for gun sales. And I wonder if you're hopeful that having a Democrat-controlled House now would actually have this legislation passed?
Oh, I think it would definitely pass the House. There are enough Republicans who would support it. In fact, the majority of Americans support universal background checks. And we in Illinois have universal background checks with the FOID card system. You know, it's crazy that someone can go to a gun show and buy an assault weapon without having to do a background check. And so I have very high hopes that a universal background check piece of legislation would have bipartisan support and would be able to be passed.
In the Senate as well?
I think so. Are there enough Republicans who would vote for it? And in fact, over 90% of the Republican, of Republicans say they support universal background check, not just elected officials.
Moving away from Washington, I wanted to ask you about your idea to have a national monument in Springfield on the site of the 1908 race riots. And it was actually kind of surprising to me that this doesn't exist already. I imagine it was also a surprise to you that this doesn't exist as a national monument.
It's very surprising to me that it doesn't exist as a national monument, especially for something that is absolutely the beginning of the NAACP. This race riot resulted in a number of people killed, including a gentleman who was an 84-year-old cobbler, William Donegan, who was stabbed and hung from a tree. The reaction to the race riot and the death resulted in the creation of the NAACP, which has done so much to support and move the case for race relations forward in our nation. And I really want our nation to learn from the lessons in the past to fight prejudices today. And the other thing that I found very shocking is that less than a quarter of our national parks recognize histories of diverse peoples and cultures. And so I think that makes it even more important to get this site recognized as a national park monument.
One last question for you, Senator Duckworth. When we're thinking about this new year, the change in the House, but the still very bitter divide in the country as we enter this 19th day of the shutdown, the longest we've ever had has been 21 days. I just wanted to ask how you're feeling about the state of politics in Washington.
Well, I choose to be hopeful. Some days it's harder than others. I choose to be hopeful. I became hopeful when I learned that the House passed their budget to reopen government in a bipartisan way, that some Republicans did vote for it. And I get more hopeful every day when my colleagues like Cory Gardner or Lisa Murkowski or Susan Collins step forward and say we need to reopen government. So I know there's bipartisanship. I've been able to pass legislation, and as recently as this week, President Trump signed into law a piece of legislation I just passed that gives veteran business owners access to surplus federal government property. So I know there's bipartisanship and we can get this done. This whole shutdown is really President Trump's decision and his desire to do this, and it's going to take bipartisan effort here to really push him to let's reopen government. And I think that I hope that there is a desire to do that. And every day I hear more from Republicans that they've had enough of the shutdown.
Senator Tammy Duckworth, thanks for speaking with us this morning.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
So let's turn to things the government is actually doing and getting things done. There's a new law that was originally introduced by Illinois Representative Robin Kelly, and it's helping improve dental health care in struggling rural and urban communities. The legislation was signed by President Trump last month into law, and it's intended to allow more groups to qualify for federal grants that develop and expand different dental health programs. How might communities here in Illinois benefit from this new Action for Dental Health law? To answer that question, we're joined on the line now by Molly Parker, who's been covering this for the Southern paper. Molly, welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me on again this morning.
Dr. Cheryl Watson-Lowry is also with us. She's the president of the Chicago Dental Society and on the line from us there. Dr. Watson-Lowry, thank you for being with us as well. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me.
Doctor, I wonder, Watson-Lowry, I wonder if I could start with you. And when we think about people getting good dental care, what are the barriers that people face?
Well, there are lots of different barriers. For young parents, they may have difficulty finding childcare just to get into to see a dentist, to have someone watch their children. They may have difficulty getting off from work to get dental care. Cost may be a barrier when you have a family and small children. There are always things popping up. I have three children, so I know. There are always things that are coming up that are that may keep you from taking care of yourself. And then you have to worry about the children, too, getting them in. And if you have several children, trying to get them in for appointments, get them out of school, transportation. So there are a lot of different barriers to getting dental care.
And also, what about just the fact of whether or not people have insurance that covers dental care? What does that look like in urban areas like Chicago, Dr. Watson-Lowry?
Well, you know, depending on your job, some jobs have dental coverage, and there are other dental plans out there that I've found that a lot of my patients have been looking towards and signing up for. But what I like to talk to my patients about is I try to help them understand that you don't have to have dental coverage to see a dentist. You know, you can, you know, find out how much will it cost to get a checkup and cleaning. If you're doing the things that you need to do, you're watching your diet, you're cleaning your teeth after every meal, or at least cleaning them before you go to bed, you go in for your checkup and you're cleaning twice a year, a lot of times that's less expensive to just get the checkup and cleaning every year than, you know, getting the insurance if you're taking care of your teeth. So if you, you know, have a discussion with your dentist, if you don't have insurance, talk to them about it. Say, I don't have insurance. You know, I'm going to come in for my checkup and clean. How much will that cost me if I come in twice a year? And patients may find that it's less expensive than they actually think to do that, even if they don't have insurance.
And Molly, you've been reporting on this from the other side of the state. What does this look like in areas like the in both, I'm thinking both the towns of Southern Illinois and places like Carbondale, as well as in rural areas?
Well, there's a shortage of providers of all types throughout a lot of downstate Illinois, and that includes, I think, for dental health as much as it does for physical health and mental health. There are some providers who are there to fill the gap for affordable dental care, places like Shawnee Healthcare, the SIU School of Dental Medicine, and at the Edwardsville campus that's a part of. And then, of course, we have the Dental Hygienist Program in Carbondale. A lot of good programs there for people who may lack access to insurance and can't afford coverage. But it's obviously a need that isn't completely fulfilled, especially in our area. We have a lot of low-income families and also seniors who, you know, as they age, have increasing dental needs that, when they're not addressed, also can affect their physical health directly.
And when we talk about this issue, I know the whole idea of Medicaid reimbursement when it comes to dental care is an important piece of this. Dr. Watson-Lowry, I just wanted to ask you about that, because in Illinois, Medicaid reimburses dentists at about 20 cents on the dollar. It's actually one of the lowest reimbursement rates in the country. And I wonder how you think that contributes to a lack of adequate coverage for people.
That's a huge barrier. You know, dentists and the Illinois State Dental Society, Chicago Dental Society, we've been advocating, talking to the state legislature to ask them to, if they just increase the reimbursement rate, there wouldn't be the that particular barrier to care. In other states where they've raised the reimbursement rate, they've seen a huge number of dentists signing up for the program, and then there becomes more access immediately. And so that's something we've been working on. We've been trying to help them understand that when patients get in and have their have an oral exam, have a checkup, we do oral cancer screenings. We're looking for all kinds of things, and they do those things then, and they increase that the access to care in that way. A lot of times that can bring the medical costs down even. So getting patients in, taking care of those things can end up lowering the cost. We found that patients that go to the emergency room for pain or infection, dental infection, it ends up costing the state 10 times as much as it would as the state would pay to just have the patient come to a dentist and actually receive care. When the patients are going to the emergency rooms, they're not receiving care. They're just getting antibiotics and pain medication. And then in a couple weeks or a month or so, the pain comes back, and then they're missing work, and that's costing the state money too.
And, of course, that's something that could have been – that's something that clearly could have been prevented on an earlier basis as well.
Exactly.
We're going to take a – we're going to have to take a break here, but when we come back, we're going to get to a little bit about what this new law does specifically, how this will change and improve things. Again, this is the Action for Dental Health Law. We're speaking with Molly Parker, who's been covering this for the Southern, and the president of the Chicago Dental Society, Dr. Cheryl Watson-Lowry. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. We'll pick up this conversation just on the other side of this short break. Tuning into the 21st, I'm Nyla Boodoo. Right now, we're talking about a new law that was signed by President Trump last month, introduced by Illinois Representative Robin Kelly, that's aimed to improve dental health care in both rural and urban communities. My guests are Molly Parker, who's a reporter for the Southern Illinoisan newspaper, and Dr. Cheryl Watson-Lowry, who's president of the Chicago Dental Society. We were just talking about Medicaid reimbursement rates over before the break. Dr. Watson-Lowry, I just wanted to ask you very quickly, how would that change? Would we have to have, would that be a change in the state house in terms of how much Illinois reimburses for Medicaid?
Yes, a big part of that is what the state is covering. And like I mentioned before, if the state kind of moves that money, they're paying for emergency room care, and that's part of the Action for Dental Health is ER diversion, trying to get patients from the emergency room to actual dental offices or facilities, FQHCs and different clinics, get them actually to those clinics so that they can receive the care that they need.
And Molly, when we're thinking about this new law in particular, how is this going to change things?
Well, I ask some questions about the specifics on this. I think people are very hopeful about it as far as what it does. The American Dental Association told me in an email that it doesn't they can't go so far as to say it guarantees new funding, but would enable the Department of Health and Human Services to award grants, enter into contracts to collaborate with state and local entities of government and other stakeholders, private and nonprofit stakeholders, to implement new programs and expand existing programs that are designed to do a lot of what Dr. Watson-Lowry is talking about, servicing underserved communities, particularly rural and urban communities that have resource gaps. They're talking about creating dental homes where instead of going to the emergency room, you know where your provider is if you start to have problems with your teeth and with your dental care, that you know where to make an appointment and how to access that care as opposed to letting it become an emergency. And things like mobile vans and services in schools that reach children where they are, services for nursing home residents. That's become a really big issue nationally about nursing home residents who have been neglected, their dental care has been neglected. And I think there's a lot of renewed focus on the fact that dental care really directly affects healthcare. It's not something that is cosmetic. It really can cause people to become very ill and very uncomfortable.
I want to go back to that. Right. Yeah. Go ahead, Molly. I want to go back to that point in a minute, but finish your thought there.
No, I just wanted to say that I think it's something that folks are hopeful may direct some funding here without saying yet at this point. It was an appropriation bill, so it's hard to say exactly how it may play out.
Mm-hmm. Right. Dr. Watson-Lowry, who and where do you see benefiting most from this new law?
Well, I think the underserved community in both rural and urban areas can definitely benefit from this new law. A lot of the dental societies and a lot of the governmental agencies know where the gaps exist. So the key is putting programs together to get access to the federal funding so that these programs can be put into action and accomplish the goals that we want to have done. We want to have patients actually receive care. We want to have more dental education. Dentistry is one of the only professions that's constantly trying to put ourselves out of business. We're constantly talking to patients about prevention and what they need to do. And so just talking to patients and letting them know, you know, it's important to clean your teeth before you go to bed every night so that food's not sitting there and causing dental disease. It's important to let them know to stop drinking so much soda pop and sweetened beverages so they're getting cavities on their front teeth and sucking on all kinds of breath mints and lozenges and things like that, which are causing cavities in their back teeth. Just getting the education to the patients and letting them know little things that they're doing that may be increasing, you know, the problems that they're having. And if they can change their habits, they can make a huge difference in their oral health, and making sure that we help them access things that are causing barriers to their care. Those will go a long way to getting patients in a healthier state, because healthy teeth and gums aren't a luxury. They are essential, and it's important to your overall health, and that's what we're trying to the message we're trying to get across.
One last question for you, Dr. Watson-Lowry. To Molly's point that she made earlier about dental care, do you feel like the lack of dental care gets enough attention? Do you think that when we talk about healthcare issues, access to care, people are thinking about dental care and how much that affects people's overall medical health?
Well, as a dentist, I don't think it receives enough attention. But part of the access to dental health bill provides for collaboration with other healthcare providers. You know, talking to the nurses, the physicians, other people that have contact with patients, and let them know how important it is, especially with patients with heart disease and diabetes. Let the patients know, get in to see your dentist. When was the last time you had a checkup? Some things that patients may not even think about that may be affecting their health. When patients are on a lot of medication, sometimes that causes them to have dry mouth, which can increase their tooth decay. So if we are collaborating with other healthcare providers and letting them know these things are important, this is how it can affect your overall health, and making sure that they're talking to patients to get them in for their regular checkups, I think getting that attention and getting patients to be more aware and other professionals to be more aware, I think it'll go a long way to making our society a healthier place to be.
Dr. Cheryl Watson-Lowry is president of the Chicago Dental Society. I want to thank Molly Parker as well. Her reporting on this we will tweet out for the Southern if you would like to read more, particularly as Molly's talking about how this affects the aging population and other parts of outside of Chicago. Molly, Dr. Watson-Lowry, thank you for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Having a baby is a life-changing event for many mothers. It can also be the most challenging and painful experience of their lives. And while it might seem counterintuitive, early research suggests that mindfulness training paying close attention to what's happening in the present moment can actually help relieve pain and improve the experience of childbirth. That's because mindfulness and meditation can help engage the body's natural calming response. To help us learn more about how all this works, I'm joined now in studio by Heidi Marie Laurent. She's an assistant professor of psychology at the University of Illinois, where she studies and teaches about mindfulness and meditation. And Jerry Lake is also here with us. She's a nurse midwife who's also trained in mindfulness and childbirth, and they're both part of Mindful Birth CU, which offers childbirth and parenting classes to pregnant women and their support partners. Jerry, Heidi Marie, both of you, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here with me.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks.
Heidi Marie, I wonder if we could start with you. I mentioned that you study mindfulness as a researcher, but you're also the mother of twins, and you used mindfulness techniques during their birth. What was that like? Can you tell us how it helped?
Yeah, so I did actually seek out training in mindfulness-based childbirth and parenting initially as a researcher, so before I was pregnant or having kids myself, and I was looking for ways to apply mindfulness during the perinatal period, where I was already interested in stress and depression in mothers and how we might be able to mitigate that. So I went to this initial training that Jerry has also taken part in, mostly just to see what this was like and how could I apply it in my research. Then when I became pregnant myself some years later, I felt really that I had all the preparation that I needed to go into it. So I didn't take any other childbirth classes. And I do think it helped in a couple of ways. One was coming to terms with the way that the birth process was going to unfold. So I, like a lot of women, wanted to have a totally natural childbirth. Maybe in a home or sort of a less medical kind of setting. And the way that things progressed with my pregnancy, the twins were starting to show slower weight gain toward the end of the pregnancy, and there was some concern about their health. And so it was determined that I needed to be induced with Pitocin. And I think being able to just take that in as this is the reality that I need to work with and see, you know, how within those constraints can I have the birth that I want and be satisfied with that was important. When I was actually going in and being induced, of course, there was the birth process, and Pitocin, you know, tends to speed up the rate at which you get to the really strong, intense contractions.
Right, it really accelerates your contractions when your body may not be ready to actually give birth.
Exactly. So you can have an additional challenge. it does speed things up. So I would say the labor was quicker than for some, but definitely got into a pretty intense phase. And so some of the things that I'd learned from mindfulness practice and from MBCP in particular helped with being able to work with pain as a transformative experience rather than something that was signaling danger or threat, which is usually, you know, what pain signals. And so it makes sense that we would have a kind of fear reaction and all that goes with that. But to be able to approach it just as a set of sensations that in this context are bringing a baby into the world and are not sort of a sign that something is wrong already helps with kind of engaging that calming response. And then also some of the things that were highlighted of being able to rest in the spaces between contractions. So often it's easy to for our attention to get pulled to the really aversive, difficult part of our experience. And to, in the context of labor, not even be able to appreciate those spaces where, you know, actually things are pretty calm and there isn't much going on and the body and the mind can relax into that. So that was something that I used as much as I could.
So that's mindfulness. So MBCP is mindfulness-based childbirth and parenting. Jerry, you and I were actually in a mindfulness class together. It was more than a year ago. It was
about two years ago.
Mm-hmm. And I think this is for people who haven't gone through this. It's kind of counterintuitive to think that when you're in pain, you should pay attention to the pain, because I think oftentimes our natural instinct is to kind of separate ourselves from our body or pretend or just try to find a way to distance ourselves from the pain. How do when particularly when we're thinking about childbirth, how do you feel like paying attention to the pain the way Heidi Marie was just explaining to it, how else can that be make it a more helpful experience?
Yeah. Pardon me. I think Heidi Marie hit on a good point there. Often what happens in childbirth is when contractions are coming in you know, all day long or however long the labor takes place, it's easy to, if you're not staying present to what actually happened in each moment, to find out that you're spending time either worrying about what's coming next or reflecting back on, oh, that last one was really hard. I don't know how much longer I can do this. Am I going to be ready for the next? And if you're present, yes, for that 60 to 90 seconds of that contraction, you do have to function with that pain. And then, yes, for the next 2 to 3 minutes, if you can stay present and not be rehashing what just happened or worrying about what comes next, then you can really inhabit that space that, because of the way the body reacts with endorphins, that you actually may notice that you feel really good. It's not just that the pain's not there, it's that you actually feel good in that time between.
And Heidi Marie, do you think that's a definition of mindfulness, a good definition of what Jerry was just describing, actually just paying full attention to what's happening in the present moment?
I think that's a really key part. And the other part that is there, and I've come to appreciate more and more over time, is that it's a way of being in the present moment. So not just am I paying attention, but I'm paying attention in a way that is open, that is accepting, that is allowing this to be here, and not adding the additional struggle and resistance that tends to create more suffering, whether physical or emotional.
And so, Jerry, how have you seen this happen in the context of childbirth with other people as a midwife?
So at this point, I'm not actively practicing, but I'm having class participants come back and speak to the next groups after they've had their babies. It's really been interesting to hear what they say. First of all, they report that one of the biggest factors is exactly what Heidi Marie was talking about. Being able to be present to and accept or allow the labor that they get rather than some, if you will, dream labor or fantasy labor that they hope to get. One of the biggest things I saw in practice was women coming back who had either had to have inductions that they didn't particularly want or C-sections.
Something that happened that they weren't planning for.
Exactly. And feeling that in some way they failed, that their body didn't work right, they didn't do it well enough, they had an epidural when they thought they weren't going to take pain medication, whatever it was, that wasn't in their idealized birth plan. By helping people understand, embrace the concept of mindfulness that we often call the don't know mind, that we really aren't in control, and that labor is going to unfold. And if you can just be with it, be open to it. One of the biggest things I hear from the women when they come back is, you know what, something happened that I didn't think I wanted, but it was okay. I stayed with it. I did my best in the moment, kind of suspending the judgment, the judging mind a little bit about what happened, and just moving into that space seems to have a huge benefit for women.
Heidi Marie, you're teaching, so you all have been teaching classes. How long have you been teaching these classes?
So I only got to teach the first round with actually Jerry and Christy Higgs of mindfulness-based childbirth and parenting, but I am continuing to be engaged in other mindfulness classes that are offered. So we have some that are not just for pregnant women and partners. So I've been involved in teaching various forms of mindfulness classes for some years. And now I'm partnering with Christy and Jerry on the MBCP classes that are going on.
And right. And I know there's a new class that just started this past Sunday. We have to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue this conversation with Heidi Marie Laurent and with Jerry Lake talking about this Mindful Birth CU for folks who are in the Champaign-Urbana area, these classes that are available. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo, and we're talking about Mindful Birth CU. They offer childbirth and parenting classes to pregnant women and their support partners. We've been talking about not just the classes, but the research that's been being done by Heidi Marie Laurent. She's an assistant professor of psychology at the University of Illinois. Jerry Lake is a nurse midwife who also teaches mindfulness as part of these Mindful Birth classes. Heidi Marie, I wanted to ask you about the research that you've been doing into all of this. What do we know and what do we not know about how mindfulness is helpful when specifically when it comes to childbirth and the experience of childbirth? And then I wonder if you've looked at all about parenting and later on in life. Mm-hmm.
All right. I'll try to keep myself confined to a few things because I could talk a lot about that. But there is some early evidence for specifically for mindfulness-based childbirth and parenting effects improving women's anxiety and depression and helping them to feel more confident going into the birth process.
Both during pregnancy and afterwards?
Yes, yes. So there are some follow-up kinds of things after the baby is born. But really, it's been focused so far mostly on the mother herself. And I was interested in how she's relating to her baby after the baby is born, and also looking beyond sort of self-report measures to biological measures. So some of the research I've done showed that mothers with perinatal depression were showing a kind of blunted brain response to their baby's emotion cues, and that might be part of what is making it hard for them to respond sensitively to their baby in a way that would help them learn to kind of cope with stress and develop in a resilient way. So it struck me that some of those same brain areas that were hyporesponsive in the depressed mothers also tend to be strengthened by mindfulness practice. And so the research that we're starting up now and will be hopefully in the next few months, we'll start with classes that are part of this study, is looking at how prenatal mindfulness training through MBCP may impact not only mothers, again, mental health and their sort of subjective sense of bonding with their babies, but also the way that their brains are responding to their babies in an MRI scanner.
And what about partners or other support folks during this process?
So one of the unique things about MBCP compared to other mindfulness trainings is that it's meant to involve not just the individual, but really a team. And so not only the pregnant woman takes part in the classes, but also a partner, whether that's the father or other romantic partner or some other support person. And recognizing that with mindfulness, we can be strengthening sort of the larger system in which this pregnancy and childbirth happens and where there is parenting support after the baby is born, so that partners are also learning all of these skills, learning how to better support the pregnant woman, but that they're really birthing a whole family and that's what they're preparing for.
Jerry, for people who are interested in more information, what are good resources points for them, especially the classes here and then for folks who are listening throughout the state?
Yeah. Our website is mindfulbirthcu, and that lists the current classes as well as some information about the classes and us as teachers.
For people in Central Illinois.
For people in the area that mm-hmm. That can come to Champaign-Urbana area for classes. Nancy Bardicky is a CNM who founded this program, and she has a website called mindfulbirthing.org, I believe. And you can, if you search her name or that website, you can find listings of classes in other areas.
And maybe I could just put in a plug for people who are interested in some of the research that we're doing, both research involving mindfulness training and sort of more basic research looking at differences in mothers' mindfulness and how that relates to health and well-being. Our website at the University of Illinois is the PRISM Lab, which stands for Personal Relationships, Interpersonal Stress, and Mindfulness. And you can also email psychprismlab@illinois.edu to find out more about upcoming study opportunities that include being able to attend one of these classes at no cost to be part of this study.
We will put that information at our website as well. So we'll have that up after the show at 21stshow.org. But I want to thank Heidi Marie Laurent. She's been sharing her research at the University of Illinois, and Jerry Lake, a nurse midwife, both of them involved in Mindful Birth. See you. Both of you, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Nyla.
Thank you, Nyla.
It's good to be here.
Listening to the 21st, I'm Nyla Boodoo. Have you been watching the new Lifetime documentary, Surviving R. Kelly? If so, you're not alone. It scored record ratings for the network, and more importantly, it may lead to new criminal investigations of the R&B singer born Robert Kelly, better known as R. Kelly, and his alleged abuse of girls and women throughout his career. Just a note for our audience, we're going to be talking about this topic of sexual abuse for the rest of the program. Here's a clip from the Lifetime series, Surviving R. Kelly.
Can you describe the physical abuse? God, I can't take another day. I can't do this anymore.
It shouldn't have happened.
Why didn't anyone notice? We all noticed. No one cared because we were black girls.
Since the six-part series aired, there have been two more investigations in two states that have been opened into R. Kelly, including Cook County State's Attorney Kim Fox, who had a news conference about this yesterday. Kathy Cheney is one of the many people who were interviewed in the series. She's a longtime Chicago journalist who's currently a deputy managing editor at the Chicago Sun-Times, and she's on the line from their newsroom there now. Hi, Kathy. Welcome to the 21st.
Hi, thank you, Nyla.
So, Kathy, when we're thinking about the reaction to all of this, it's been pretty overwhelming if people have been paying attention, especially to the social media around this over the past week or so. But Cook County State's Attorney Kim Fox watched as well. And I want to play a little bit of what she said yesterday about this.
The recent allegations against entertainer R. Kelly and the recent Lifetime documentary series are deeply, deeply disturbing. It is our job here at the Cook County State's Attorney's Office to investigate claims in the interest of justice and of public safety.
That audio from the Chicago Sun-Times. Kathy, what else did State's Attorney Kim Fox say yesterday about all of this?
She pretty much said that, and the Sun-Times talked to her before she had this press conference, and she said that one of the victims, the alleged victims, came to her in early 2018, shortly after the BuzzFeed article came out that Jim DeRogatis did, a former Sun-Times reporter. And she said that the alleged victim contacted the office with her attorney, and she said that she wanted to, you know, speak out. And Kim Fox said that her office said, you know, okay, let's set up time for you to meet with the head of our sex crimes division, and the alleged victim and her attorney never followed up with them. She was stressing that her office really, their hands are tied unless witnesses and victims come forward. They take all the allegations seriously. They will investigate all claims fully, but they need the victims and witnesses to come forward and contact their office.
For those of us who haven't seen this docuseries, there are lots of people who were interviewed, like we're thinking about even John Legend, Tom Joyner. You are one of the folks that they interview. What's striking is these, as we heard a little bit of these horrific first-person accounts from women who are describing abuse. I wonder what stuck with you after watching this?
The main thing that stuck with me was that you have so many women who are speaking up, speaking out. They're all independent, you know, statements, but very similar, which leads you to believe that there has to be some truth to any and all of the claims. It's not like the women all band together or, you know, got on, you know, a group chat and said, hey, this is what we're going to say, or this is what I'm going to say, is something you're going to say similar. These are all women independently making their statements, recounting their alleged abuse, and mostly all of the, you know, details are very similar. So that's what was really striking to me. And I, like a lot of other people, you know, said that when you've heard about all the allegations and you've read about them, you saw them on the news, it's different and kind of hits home and makes you cry inside when you put faces to the alleged abusers, because they're there right on your screen talking to you, telling you what they have gone through. So that's what stuck to me. That really, you know, just hit home.
Kathy, you mentioned Jim DeRogatis. He started reporting on this when he was at the Sun-Times. The reporting on this has been going on for years. I know you and I, mm-hmm. together, when we worked at WBEZ with Jim DeRogatis, we talked about this. He, mm-hmm. went to trial. R. Kelly went to trial. He was acquitted in 2008. He's consistently denied all allegations of sexual misconduct and physical abuse against girls and women. This is 20 years later now. We're still, mm-hmm. hearing these stories and this. What do you think, how do you think this docuseries might change things? Or are we seeing things change in terms of his music being played? We've seen some more investigations. Do you think this is changing things?
I think that it will change a little. I know that his diehard, hardcore fans will never go away.
And so a lot of those are a lot of those in Chicago? In Chicago?
Oh, all over, yes. All over. They will continue to support him. They've even come out on social media saying that they continue to stand behind him. You will have some people that will never believe the victims. So that part, a lot of people can't separate the music from the man. So he's still going to have people stepping in the name of love, bumping and grinding and, you know, putting the key in the ignition. He's going to continue to have those hardcore fans that are going to go to bat for him all the time. So that part I'm not surprised about. But there will be, we've seen that the Georgia DA yesterday with news came out that they're opening up an investigation. We've seen Kim Fox, our Cook County State's attorney, say that, you know, they're willing to look at everything if some witnesses and victims come forward. So I think there's a little bit of change as far as his music being played. That's very interesting because our former colleague, Natalie Moore, WBEZ, she and I were talking about this yesterday where we were trying to contact the radio stations in Chicago to find out if they're going to continue to keep his songs, you know, in rotation on the playlist. And we've heard crickets from them for, you know, like the last 2 days.
So for all the Chicago hip-hop and R&B stories. So this will continue as well. Well, Kathy Cheney, and there's so much more we could talk about this, but we appreciate you joining us to tell us a little bit more about this ongoing story regarding R. Kelly, the Lifetime series Surviving R. Kelly. Just a note, Kim Fox, state's attorney, Cook County state's attorney, is urging possible victims to reach out to their local police department or to the state's attorney's sexual assault and domestic violence division. That phone number is 773-674-6492. If you need to speak to someone and you need help, you can always call the National Sexual Assault Telephone Hotline. That number is 1-800-656-4673. We will have both of these numbers up at our website. Kathy, thank you for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Coming up on tomorrow's program, we are going to be talking about what's to come with a new set of lawmakers and a new governor in Springfield. As I mentioned yesterday, we've unveiled a new feature on our website. It's called Ask the 21st. That's askthe21st.org. And if you've got questions about our new governor and our state lawmakers, we'd love to hear from you. And we're going to try to answer them Monday during our live show from Springfield, from the brink of Springfield Convention Center as the inauguration ceremonies happen. I mentioned our website is always a good place for resources. All the phone numbers, all of the links that we've mentioned today. If you want to get in contact with us as well, all you have to do is go to 21stshow.org. were produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, Alan Montesilio, and Vishesh Anand. Bobby McSwine is our intern. Thanks to Christine Herman for her producing help today as well. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening. See you back here tomorrow.